Did they wear crimson cloaks or fly a lion banner? Even Lannisters are not so blind stupid as that, Sir Mark Piper snapped. He was a swaggering bantam rooster of a youth, too young and too hot-blooded for Ned's taste, though a fast friend of Catelyn's brother, Edmure Tully. Every man among them was mounted and mailed, my lord, Sir Carol answered calmly. They were armed with steel-tipped lances and longswords, with battle-axes for the butchery. He gestured toward one of the ragged survivors. You, yes, you, no one's going to hurt you. Tell the hand what you told me. The old man bobbed his head.
Concerning their horses, he said, it were war horses they rode. Many a year I walked in old Sir Willem's stables, so I knows the difference. Not a one of these ever pulled a plough. God's bear witness if I'm wrong.
Well mounted, brigands, observed Littlefinger. Perhaps they stole the horses from the last place they raided. How many men were there in this raiding party? Ned asked. 100 at the least, Joss answered, in the same instant as the bandaged smith said, 50. And the grandmother behind him,
Onards and onards, my lord, an army there was.
You are more right than you know, good woman, Lord Eddard told her. You say they flew no banners. What of the armour they wore? Did any of you note ornaments or decorations, devices on shields or helm? The brewer, Joss, shook his head.
It grieves me, my lord, but no. The armour they showed us was plain, only the one who led them. He was armoured like the rest, but there was no mistaking him all the same. It was the size of him, my lord. Those as say the giants are all dead never saw this one, I swear. Big as an ox he was, and a voice like stone breaking.
The mountain, Sir Mark said loudly. Can any man doubt it? This was Gregor Clegane's work.
Ned heard muttering from beneath the windows and the far end of the hall. Even in the galley, nervous whispers were exchanged. High lords and small folk alike knew what it could mean if Sir Mark was proved right. Sir Gregor Clegane stood bannerman to Lord Tywin Lannister. He studied the frightened faces of the villagers. Small wonder they had been so fearful. They had thought they were being dragged here to name Lord Tywin a red-handed butcher before a king who was his son by marriage. He wondered if the knights had given them a choice. Grand Maester Pycelle rose ponderously from the council table, his chain of office clinking.
Sir Mark, with respect, you cannot know that this outlaw was Sir Gregor. There are many large men in the realm.
As large as the mountain that rides, Sir Carol said. I've never met one.
Nor has any man here, Sir Raymond added hotly. Even his brother is a pup beside him. My lords, open your eyes. Do you need to see his seal on the corpses? This was Gregor.
Why should Sir Gregor turn brigand? Pycelle asked. By the grace of his liege lord, he holds a stout keep and lands of his own. The man is an anointed knight.
A false knight, Sir Mark said. Lord Tywin's mad dog.
My lord hand, Pycelle declared in a stiff voice, I urge you to remind this good knight that Lord Tywin Lannister is the father of our own gracious queen.
Thank you, Grand Maester Pycelle, Ned said. I fear we might have forgotten that if you hadn't pointed it out. From his vantage point at the top of the throne, he could see men slipping out the door at the far end of the hall. Hares going to ground, he supposed, or rats off to nibble the queen's cheese. He caught a glimpse of Septa Mordain in the gallery, with his daughter Sansa behind her. Ned felt a flash of anger. This was no place for a girl. But the Septa could not have known that today's court would be anything but the usual tedious business of hearing petitions, settling disputes between rival holdfasts, and adjudicating the placement of boundary stones. At the council table below, Petire Baelish lost interest in his quill and leaned forward. "Sir Mark, Sir Carl, Sir Raymond, perhaps I might ask you a question. These Holdfasts were under your protection. Where were you when all this slaughtering and burning was going on?" Sir Carl Vance answered, "I was attending my Lord Father in the pass below the Golden Tooth, as was Sir Mark. When the word of these outrages reached Sir Edmure Tully, he sent word that we should take a small force of men to find what survivors we could and bring them to the king." Sir Raymond Darry spoke up.
"Sir Edmure had summoned me to River Run with all my strength. I was camped across the river from his walls, awaiting his commands, when the word reached me. By the time I could return to my own lands, Clegane and his vermin were back across the Red Fork, riding for Lannister's hills."
Littlefinger stroked the point of his beard thoughtfully. "And if they come again, sir?"
"If they come again, we'll use their blood to water the fields they burnt," Sir Mark Piper declared hotly.
"Sir Edmure has sent men to every village and Holdfast within a day's ride of the border," Sir Carol explained. "The next raider will not have such an easy time of it." "And that may be precisely what Lord Tywin wants," Ned thought to himself, "to bleed off strength from River Run, goad the boy into scattering his swords." His wife's brother was young, and more gallant than wise. He would try to hold every inch of his soil to defend every man, woman, and child who named him lord. And Tywin Lannister was shrewd enough to know that.
"If your fields and Holdfasts are safe from harm," Lord Petire was saying, "what then do you ask of the throne?"
"The lords of the tyrant keep the king's peace," Sir Raymond Darry said. "The Lannisters have broken it. We ask leave to answer them steel for steel. We ask justice for the small folk of Shearer and Winchestown and the Mummer's Ford."
"Edmure agrees we must pay Gregor Clegane back his bloody coin," Sir Mark declared. "But old Lord Hoster command us to come here and beg the king's leave before we strike."
"Thank the gods for old Lord Hoster, then." Tywin Lannister was as much fox as lion. If indeed he sent Sir Gregor to burn and pillage, and Ned did not doubt that he had, he'd taken care to see that he rode under cover of night, without banners, in the guise of a common brigand. Should River Run strike back, Cersei and her father would insist that it had been the Tullys who broke the king's peace, not the Lannisters. The guards only knew what Robert would believe. Grand Maester Pycelle was on his feet again.
"My Lord Hand, if these good folk believe that Sir Gregor has forsaken his holy vows for plunder and rape, let them go to his liege lord and make their complaint. These crimes are no concern of the throne. Let them seek Lord Tywin's justice."
"It is all the king's justice," Ned told him. "North, south, east, or west. All we do in Robert's name."
"The king's justice," Grand Maester Pycelle said. "So it is, and we should defer this matter until the king..."
"The king is hunting across the river and may not return for days," Lord Eddard said. "Robert bid me to sit here in his place, to listen with his ears and to speak with his voice. I mean to do just that. Though I agree he must be told. He saw a familiar face beneath the tapestry. Sir Robert Royce stepped forward and bowed. "My lord?" "Your father is hunting with the king," Ned said. "Will you bring them word of what was said and done here today?"
"At once, my lord."
"Do we have your leave to take our vengeance against Sir Gregor, then?" Mark Piper asked the throne. "Vengeance," Ned said. "I thought we were speaking of justice. Burning Clegane's fields and slaughtering his people will not restore the king's peace, only your injured pride." He glanced away before the young knight could voice his outraged protest and address the villagers. "People of Shara, I cannot give you back your homes or your crops, nor can I restore your dead to life. But perhaps I can give you some small measure of justice in the name of our king, Robert." Every eye in the hall was fixed on him, waiting. Slowly, Ned struggled to his feet, pushing himself up from the throne with the strength of his arms, his shattered leg screaming inside its cast. He did his best to ignore the pain. It was no moment to let them see his weakness. The first man believed that the judge who called for death should wield the sword, and in the north we hold to that still. I mislike sending another to do my killing. Yet it seems I have no choice. He gestured at his broken leg. Lord Eddard, a shot came from the west side of the hall, as a handsome stripling of a boy strode forth boldly. Out of his armor, Solaris Tyrell looked even younger than his 16 years. He wore pale blue silk, his belt a linked chain of golden roses, the sigil of his house. I beg you the honor of acting in your place. Give this task to me, my lord, and I swear I shall not fail you. Littlefinger chuckled. Solaris, if we send you off alone, Sir Gregor will send us back your head with a plum stuffed in that pretty mouth of yours. The mountain is not the sort to bend his neck to any man's justice. I do not fear Gregor Clegane, Solaris said haughtily. Ned eased himself slowly back onto the hard iron seat of Aegon's misshapen throne. His eyes searched the faces along the wall. Lord Beric, he called out. Thoris of Myr, Sir Gladden, Lord Lothar. The men named stepped forward one by one. Each of you is to assemble 20 men, to bring my word to Gregor's keep. 20 of my own guard shall go with you. Lord Beric Dondarrion, you shall have the command, as befits your rank. The young lord with the red-gold hair bowed. As you command, Lord Eddard. Ned raised his voice, so it carried to the far end of the throne room. In the name of Robert, of the House Baratheon, the first of his name, King of the Andals, of the Ronar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm, by the word of Eddard of the House Stark, his hand, I charge you to ride to the Westlands with all haste, to cross the red fork of the Trident under the king's flag, and there bring the king's justice to the false knight Gregor Clegane. And to all those who share in his crimes, I denounce him and attaint him, and strip him of all rank and titles, of all lands and incomes and holdings, and do sentence him to death. May the gods take pity on his soul. When the echo of his words had died away, the Knight of Flowers seemed perplexed.
Lord Eddard, what of me?
Ned looked down on him. From on high, Laris Tyrell seemed almost as young as Rob. No one doubts your valor, Sir Laris, but we are about justice here, and what you seek is vengeance. He looked back to Lord Beric. Ride at first light. These things are best done quickly. He held up a hand. The throne will hear no more petitions today. Alan and Porther climbed the steep iron steps to help him back down. As they made their descent, he could feel Laris Tyrell's sullen stare, but the boy had stalked away before Ned reached the floor of the throne room. At the base of the Iron Throne, Varys was gathering papers from the council table. Littlefinger and Grand Maester Pycelle had already taken their leave.
"You are a bolder man than I, my lord," the eunuch said softly.
"How so, Lord Varys?" Ned asked brusquely. His leg was throbbing, and he was in no mood for word games.
"Had it been me up there, I should have sent Sir Lawrence. He so wanted to go. And a man who has the Lannisters for enemies would do well to make the Tyrells his friends.
Sir Lawrence is young, said Ned. I dare say he will outgrow the disappointment.
And Sir Ilion, the eunuch stroked a plump powdered cheek. He is the king's justice, after all, sending other men to do his office. Some might construe that as a grave insult.
No slight was intended. In truth, Ned did not trust the mute knight, though perhaps that was only because he misliked executioners. I remind you, the Paynes are bannermen to House Lannister. I thought it best to choose men who owed Lord Tywin no fealty.
Very prudent, no doubt, Varys said. Still, I chanced to see Sir Ilion in the back of the hall, staring at us with those pale eyes of his, and I must say, he did not look pleased. Though, to be sure, it's hard to tell with our silent knight. I hope he outgrows his disappointment as well. He does so love his work.
Sansa. He wouldn't send Sir Loras, Sansa told Jane Poole that night as they shared a cold supper by lamplight. I think it was because of his leg.
Lord Eddard had taken his supper in his bedchamber with Alan, Harwin, and Vaen Poole, the better to rest his broken leg, and Septa Mordaine had complained of sore feet after standing in the gallery all day. Arya was supposed to join them, but she was late coming back from her dancing lesson.
"His leg?" Jane said uncertainly. She was a pretty, dark-haired girl of Sansa's own age.
"Did Sir Loras hurt his leg?"
"Not his leg," Sansa said, nibbling delicately at a chicken leg.
"Father's leg, silly. It hurts him ever so much it makes him cross. Otherwise, I'm certain he would have sent Sir Loras."
Her father's decision still bewildered her. When the Knight of Flowers had spoken up, she'd been sure she was about to see one of old Nan's stories come to life. Sir Gregor was the monster and Sir Loras the true hero who would slay him. He even looked a hero, so slim and beautiful, with golden roses around his slender waist and his rich brown hair tumbling down into his eyes. And then Father had refused him. It had upset her more than she could tell. She had said so much to Septa Mordaine as they descended the stairs from the gallery, but the Septa had only told her it was not her place to question her Lord Father's decisions. That was when Lord Baelish had said,
"Oh, I don't know, Septa. Some of her Lord Father's decisions could do with a bit of questioning. The young lady is as wise as she is lovely."
He made a sweeping bow to Sansa, so deep she was not quite sure whether she was being complimented or mocked. Septa Mordaine had been very upset to realize that Lord Baelish had overheard them.
"The girl was just talking, my lord," she said. "Foolish chatter. She means nothing by the comment."
Lord Baelish stroked his little pointed beard and said,
"Nothing? Tell me, child, why would you have sent Sir Loras?"
Sansa had no choice but to explain about heroes and monsters. The king's counselor smiled.
"Well, those are not the reasons I'd have given, but,
He had touched her cheek, his thumb lightly tracing the line of a cheekbone.
"Life is not a song, sweetling. You may learn that one day, to your sorrow."
Sansa did not feel like telling all that to Jane, however. It made her uneasy just to think back on it. "Sir Ilion's the king's justice, not Sir Loras," Jane said. "Lord Eddard should have sent him." Sansa shuddered. Every time she looked at Sir Ilion Payne, she shivered. He made her feel as though something dead was slithering over her naked skin. "Sir Ilion's almost like a second monster. I'm glad Father didn't pick him.
Lord Beric is as much a hero as Sir Loras. He's ever so brave and gallant."
"I suppose," Sansa said doubtfully. "Beric Dondarrion
was handsome enough, but he was awfully old, almost 22. The Knight of Flowers would have been much better. Of course, Jane had been in love with Lord Beric ever since she had first glimpsed him in the lists. Sansa thought she was being silly. Jane was only a steward's daughter, after all, and no matter how much she mooned after him, Lord Beric would never look at someone so far beneath him, even if she hadn't been half his age. It would have been unkind to say so, however, so Sansa took a sip of milk and changed the subject. "I had a dream that Joffrey would be the one to take the White Hart," she said. It had been more of a wish, actually, but it sounded better to call it a dream. Everyone knew that dreams were prophetic. White hearts were supposed to be very rare and magical, and in her heart she knew her gallant prince was worthier than his drunken father. A dream, truly. Did Prince Joffrey just go up to it and touch it with his bare hand and do it no harm? No, Sansa said. He shot it with a golden arrow and brought it back for me. In the songs, the knights never killed magical beasts. They just went up to them and touched them, and did them no harm. But she knew Joffrey liked hunting, especially the killing part. Only animals, though. Sansa was certain her prince had no part in murdering Jorry and those other poor men. That had been his wicked uncle, the Kingslayer. She knew her father was still angry about that, but it wasn't fair to blame Joff. That would be like blaming her for something that Arya had done. "I saw your sister this afternoon," Jane blurted out, as if she'd been reading Sansa's thoughts. "She was walking through the stables on her hands. Why would she do a thing like that?" "I'm sure I don't know why Arya does anything." Sansa hated stables, smelly places, full of manure and flies. Even when she went riding, she liked the boy to saddle the horse and bring it to her in the yard. "Do you want to hear about the court or not?"
"I do," Jane said.
"There was a black brother," Sansa said, "begging men for the wall, only he was kind of old and smelly. She hadn't liked that at all. She had always imagined the Night's Watch to be men like Uncle Benjen. In the songs they were called the Black Knights of the Wall. But this man had been crook-backed and hideous, and he looked as though he might have lice. If this was what the Night's Watch was truly like, she felt sorry for her bastard half-brother John. Father asked if there were any knights in the hall who would do honour to their houses by taking the black, but no one came forward. So he gave this Yoren his pick of the king's dungeons and sent him on his way. And later these two brothers came before him, free riders, from the Dornish marches, and pledged their swords to the service of the king. Father accepted their oaths. Jane yawned. "Are there any lemon cakes?" Sansa did not like being interrupted, but she had to admit lemon cakes sounded more interesting than most of what had gone on in the throne room. "Let's see," she said. The kitchen yielded no lemon cakes, but they did find half of a cold strawberry pie, and that was almost as good. They ate it on the tower steps, giggling and gossiping and sharing secrets, and Sansa went to bed that night, feeling almost as wicked as Arya. The next morning, she woke before first light and crept sleepily to her window to watch Lord Beric form up his men. They rode out as dawn was breaking over the city, with three banners going before them. The crown stag of the king flew from the high staff, the direwolf of Stark, and Lord Beric's own forked lightning standard from shorter poles. It was all so exciting. A song come to life, the clatter of swords, the flicker of torchlight, banners dancing in the wind, horses snorting and winnowing, the golden glow of sunrise slanting through the bars of the portcullis as it jerked upward. The Winterfell men looked especially fine in their silvery mail and long grey cloaks. Alan carried the Stark banner. When she saw him rein in beside Lord Beric to exchange words, it made Sansa feel ever so proud. Alan was handsomer than Jory had been. He was going to be a knight one day. The Tower of the Hand seemed so empty after they left that Sansa was even pleased to see Arya
when she went down to break her fast. "Where is everyone?" her sister wanted to know as she ripped the skin from a blood orange. "Did Father send them to hunt down Jaime Lannister?" Sansa sighed. "They rode with Lord Beric to behead Sir Gregor Clegane." She turned to Septa Mordane, who was eating porridge with a wooden spoon. "Septa, will Lord Beric spike Sir Gregor's head on his own gate, or bring it back here for the king?" She and Jane Poole had been arguing over that last night. The Septa was horror-struck. "A lady does not discuss such things over her porridge. Where are your courtesies, Sansa? I swear of late you've been near as bad as your sister." "What did Gregor do?" Arya asked. "He burnt down a whole fast and murdered a lot of people, women and children too." Arya screwed up her face in a scowl. "Jaime Lannister murdered Jory and Hewitt and Will, and the Hound murdered Micah. Somebody should have beheaded them."
"It's not the same," Sansa said. "The Hound is Geoffrey's sworn shield. Your butcher's boy attacked the prince."
"Liar," Arya said.
A hand clenched the blood orange so hard, the red juice squeezed between her fingers.
"Go ahead, call me all the names you want," Sansa said airily.
"You won't dare when I'm married to Geoffrey. You'll have to bow to me and call me your grace." She shrieked as Arya flung the orange across the table. It caught her in the middle of the forehead with a wet squish and plopped down into her lap.
"You have juice on your face, your grace," Arya said.
It was running down her nose and stinging her eyes. Sansa wiped it away with a napkin. When she saw what the fruit in her lap had done to her beautiful ivory silk dress, she shrieked again.
"You're horrible!" she screamed at her sister. "They should have killed you instead of Lady."
Septa Mordane came lurching to her feet.
"Your lord father will hear of this. Go to your chambers at once. At once."
"Me too."
Tears welled in Sansa's eyes.
"That's not fair. The matter is not subject to discussion. Go."
Sansa stalked away with her head up. She was to be a queen, and queens did not cry. At least, not where people could see. When she reached her bedchamber, she barred the door and took off her dress. The blood orange had left a blotchy red stain on the silk. "I hate her," she screamed. She balled up the dress and flung it into the cold hearth, on top of the ashes of last night's fire. When she saw that the stain had bled through onto her underskirt, she began to sob despite herself. She ripped off the rest of her clothes wildly, threw herself into bed, and cried herself back to sleep. It was midday when Septa Mordane knocked upon her door.
"Sansa, your lord father will see you now."
Sansa sat up.
"Lady,"
she whispered. For a moment, it was as if the direwolf was there in the room, looking at her with those golden eyes, sad and knowing. She had been dreaming, she realized. Lady was with her, and they were running together, and trying to remember was like trying to catch the rain with her fingers. The dream faded, and Lady was dead again.
"Sansa,"
the rap came again, sharply.
"Do you hear me?"
"Yes, Septa," she called out. "Might I have a moment to dress, please?" Her eyes were red from crying, but she did her best to make herself beautiful. Lord Eddard was bent over a huge leather-bound book when Septa Mordane marched her into the solar, his plaster-wrapped leg stiff beneath the table. "Come here, Sansa," he said, not unkindly, when the Septa had gone for her sister. "Sit beside me." He closed the book. Septa Mordane returned with Arya squirming in her grasp. Sansa had put on a lovely pale-green damask gown and a look of remorse. But her sister was still wearing the ratty leathers and rough spin she'd worn at breakfast.
"Here is the other one," the Septa announced.
"My thanks, Septa Mordane. I would talk to my daughters alone, if you would be so kind." The Septa bowed and left.
"Arya started it,"
Sansa said quickly, anxious to have the first word.
She called me a liar and threw an orange at me and spoiled my dress. The ivory silk, the one Queen Cersei gave me when I was betrothed to Prince Joffrey. She hates that I'm going to marry the prince. She tries to spoil everything. Father, she can't stand for anything to be beautiful or nice or splendid.
Enough, Sansa. Lord Eddard's voice was sharp with impatience. Arya raised her eyes.
I'm sorry, Father. I was wrong, and I beg my sweet sister's forgiveness.
Sansa was so startled that for a moment she was speechless. Finally, she found her voice.
What about my dress? Maybe I could wash it,
Arya said doubtfully.
Washing won't do any good, Sansa said. Not if you scrubbed all day and all night. The silk is ruined. Then I'll make you a new one, Arya said.
Sansa threw back her head in disdain.
You couldn't sew a dress fit to clean the pigsties.
Their father sighed. I did not call you here to talk of dresses. I'm sending you both back to Winterfell. For the second time, Sansa found herself too stunned for words. She felt her eyes grow moist again.
You can't, Arya said. Please, father.
Sansa managed at last.
Please don't.
Eddard Stark favored his daughters with a tired smile. At last we found something you agree on.
I didn't do anything wrong, Sansa pleaded with him. I don't want to go back.
She loved King's Landing, the pageantry of the court, the high lords and ladies in their velvets and silks and gemstones, the great city with all its people. The tournament had been the most magical time of her whole life, and there was so much she had not yet seen, harvest feasts and masked balls and mummer shows. She could not bear the thought of losing it all.
Send Arya away. She started it, Father. I swear it. I'll be good, you'll see. Just let me stay, and I promise to be as fine and noble and courteous as the Queen.
Father's mouth twitched strangely. Sansa, I am not sending you away for fighting, though the guards know I am sick of you two squabbling. I want you back in Winterfall for your own safety. Three of my men were cut down like dogs, not a league from where we sit. And what does Robert do? He goes hunting. Arya was chewing at her lip in that disgusting way she had.
Can we take Syria back with us?
Who cares about your stupid dancing master? Sansa flared.
Father, I only just now remembered I can't go away. I'm to marry Prince Joffrey.
She tried to smile bravely for him.
I love him, Father. I truly, truly do. I love him as much as Queen Nerys loved Prince Aemon, the Dragon Knight, as much as Jonquil loves Sir Florian. I want to be his queen and have his babies.
Sweet one, her father said gently, listen to me. When you're old enough, I will make you a match with a high lord who's worthy of you. Someone brave and gentle and strong. This match with Joffrey was a terrible mistake. That boy is no Prince Aemon. You must believe me.
He is, Sansa insisted. I don't want someone brave and gentle. I want him. We'll be ever so happy, just like in the songs, you'll see. I'll give him a son with golden hair, and one day he'll be the king of all the realm, the greatest king that ever was, as brave as a wolf and as proud as a lion.
Arya made a face.
Not if Joffrey's his father, she said. He's a liar and a craven, and anyhow he's a stag, not a lion.
Sansa felt tears in her eyes.
He is not. He's not the least bit like that old drunken king.
She screamed at her sister, forgetting herself in her grief.
Father looked at her strangely. Guards, he swore softly, out of the mouths of babes.
He shouted for Septa Mordain. To the girls he said, I'm looking for a fast-trading galley to take you home. These days the sea is safer than the King's Road. You will sail as soon as I can find a proper ship with Septa Mordain and a complement of guards, and yes, with Cirio Farrell, if he agrees to enter my service. But say nothing of this. It's better if no one knows of our plans. We will talk again tomorrow. Sansa cried as Septa Mordain marched them down the steps.
They were going to take it all away. The tournaments and the court and her prince, everything. They were going to send her back to the bleak grey walls of Winterfell and lock her up forever. Her life was over before it had begun.
"Stop that weeping, child," Septimor Dane said sternly. "I am certain your Lord Father knows what's best for you."
"It won't be so bad, Sansa," Arya said.
"We're going to sail on a galley. It'll be an adventure. And then we'll be with Bran and Rob again, and Old Nan, and Hodor and the rest."
She touched on the arm.
"Hodor!" Sansa yelled. "You ought to marry Hodor. You're just like him, stupid and hairy and ugly."
She wrenched away from her sister's hand, stormed into her bedchamber, and barred the door behind her. Eddard.
"Pain is a gift from the gods, Lord Eddard," Grand Maester Pycelle told him. "It means the bone is knitting, the flesh healing itself. Be thankful."
"I will be thankful when my leg stops throbbing."
Pycelle set a stoppered flask on the table by the bed. "The milk of the poppy, for when the pain grows too onerous."
"I sleep too much already."
"Sleep is the great healer."
"I had hoped that was you." Pycelle smiled wanly.
"It is good to see you in such a fierce humour, my lord."
He leaned close and lowered his voice.
"There was a raven this morning. A letter for the queen from her lord father. I thought you had best know."
"Dark wings, dark words," Ned said grimly. "What of it?"
"Lord Tywin is greatly wroth about the men you sent after Sir Gregor Clegane," the maester confided. "I feared he would be. You will recall, I said as much in council."
"Let him be wroth," Ned said.
Every time his leg throbbed, he remembered Jaime Lannister's smile and Jorry dead in his arms.
"Let him write all the letters to the queen he likes. Lord Beric rides beneath the king's own banner. If Lord Tywin attempts to interfere with the king's justice, he will have Robert to answer to. The only thing his grace enjoys more than hunting is making war on lords who defy him."
Pycelle pulled back, his maester's chain jangling.
As you say, I shall visit again on the morrow."
The old man hurriedly gathered up his things and took his leave. Ned had little doubt that he was bound straight for the royal apartments, to whisper at the queen.
"I thought you had best know."
Indeed. As if Cersei had not instructed him to pass along her father's threats. He hoped his response rattled those perfect teeth of hers. Ned was not near as confident of Robert as he pretended, but there was no reason Cersei need know that. When Pycelle was gone, Ned called for a cup of honeyed wine. That clouded the mind as well, yet not as badly. He needed to be able to think. A thousand times he asked himself what John Arryn might have done had he lived long enough to act on what he'd learned. Or perhaps he had acted, and died for it. It was clear how sometimes a child's innocent eyes can see things that grown men are blind to. Someday, when Sansa was grown, he would have to tell her how she had made it all come clear for him. "He's not the least bit like that old drunken king," she had declared, angry and unknowing, and the simple truth of it had twisted inside him cold as death. This was the sword that killed John Arryn, Ned thought then, and it will kill Robert as well. A slower death, but full as certain. Shattered legs may heal in time, but some betrayals fester and poison the soul. Littlefinger came calling an hour after the Grand Maester had left, clad in a plum-coloured doublet with a mockingbird embroidered on the breast in black thread and a striped cloak of black and white.
"I cannot visit long, my lord," he announced. "Lady Tanda expects me to lunch with her. No doubt she will roast me a fatted calf. If it's near as fatted as her daughter, I'm likely to rupture and die. And how's your leg?"
"Inflamed and painful, with an itch that is driving me mad."
Littlefinger lifted an eyebrow. In future, try not to let any horses fall on it. I would urge you to heal quickly. The realm grows restive. Varys has heard ominous whispers from the west. Free riders and sellswords have been flocking to Casterly Rock, and not for the thin pleasure of Lord Tywin's conversation. "Is there word of the king?" Ned demanded. "Just how long does Robert intend to hunt?" "Given his preferences, I believe he'd stay in the forest until you and the queen both die of old age," Lord Petyr replied with a faint smile. "Lacking that, I imagine he'll return as soon as he's killed something. They've found the White Hart, it seems, or rather, what remained of it. Some wolves found it first, and left his grace scarcely more than a hoof and a horn. Robert was in a fury, until he heard talk of some monstrous boar deep in the forest. Then nothing would do but that he must have it. Prince Joffrey returned this morning with the Royces, Sir Balin Swan, and some 20 others of the party. The rest are still with the king.
The Hound, Ned asked, frowning. Of all the Lannister party, Sandor Clegane was the one who concerned him the most, now that Sir Jaime had fled the city to join his father.
Oh, returned with Joffrey, and went straight to the queen, Littlefinger smiled. I would have given 100 silver stags to have been a roach in the rushes when he learned that Lord Beric was off to behead his brother.
Even a blind man could see the Hound loathed his brother.
Ah, but Gregor was his to loathe, not yours to kill. Once Dondarrion lops the summit off our mountain, the Clegane lands and income will pass to Sandor. But I wouldn't hold my water waiting for his thanks, not that one. And now you must forgive me. Lady Tanda awaits with her fatted calves.
On the way to the door, Lord Petyr spied Grand Maester Malian's massive tome on the table, and paused to idly flip open the cover.
The lineages and histories of the great houses of the Seven Kingdoms, with descriptions of many high lords and noble ladies and their children, he read.
Now, there is tedious reading, if ever I saw it. A sleeping potion, my lord? For a brief moment, Ned considered telling him all of it. But there was something in Littlefinger's japes that irked him. The man was too clever by half, a mocking smile never far from his lips.
John Arryn was studying this volume when he was taken sick, Ned said in a careful tone, to see how he might respond. And he responded, as he always did, with a quip. In that case, he said, death must have come as a blessed relief.
Lord Petyr Baelish bowed and took his leave.
Eddard Stark allowed himself a curse. Aside from his own retainers, there was scarcely a man in the city he trusted. Littlefinger had concealed Catelyn and helped Ned in his inquiries, yet his haste to save his own skin, when Jaime and his swords had come out of the rain, still rankled. Varys was worse. For all his protestations of loyalty, the eunuch knew too much and did too little. Grand Maester Pycelle seemed more Cersei's creature with every passing day, and Sir Barristan was an old man and rigid. He would tell Ned to do his duty. Time was perilously short. The king would return from his hunt soon, and honour would require Ned to go to him with all he had learned. Vaon Poole had arranged for Sansa and Arya to sail on the Windwitch out of Braavos, 3 days hence. They would be back at Winterfell before the harvest. Ned could no longer use his concern for their safety to excuse his delay. Yet, last night, he had dreamed of Rhaegar's children. Lord Tywin had laid the bodies beneath the Iron Throne, wrapped in the crimson cloaks of his house guard.
That was clever of him. The blood did not show so badly against the red cloth. The little princess had been barefoot, still dressed in her bedgown, and the boy. Ned could not let that happen again. The realm could not withstand a second mad king, another dance of blood and vengeance. He must find some way to save the children.
Robert could be merciful. Sir Barristan was scarcely the only man he had pardoned. Grand Maester Pycelle, Varys the Spider, Lord Balin Greyjoy, each had been counted an enemy to Robert once, and each had been welcomed into friendship and allowed to retain honours and office for a pledge of fealty. So long as a man was brave and honest, Robert would treat him with all the honour and respect due to a valiant enemy. There was something else. Poison in the dark. A knife thrust to the soul. This he could never forgive, no more than he had forgiven Rhaegar. He will kill them all, Ned realized. And yet, he knew he could not keep silent. He had a duty to Robert, to the realm, to the shade of John Aaron, and to Bran, who surely must have stumbled on some part of the truth. Why else would they have tried to slay him? Late that afternoon, he summoned Tomard, the portly guardsman with the ginger-coloured whiskers his children called Fat Tom. Were Jory dead and Alan gone, Fat Tom had command of his household guard. The thought filled Ned with vague disquiet. Tomard was a solid man, affable, loyal, tireless, capable in a limited way, but he was near 50, and even in his youth he had never been energetic. Perhaps Ned should not have been so quick to send off half his guard, and all his best swords among them. "I shall require your help," Ned said when Tomard appeared, looking faintly apprehensive, as he always did when called before his lord. "Take me to the guardswood."
"Is that wise, Lord Eddard, with your leg and all?"
"Perhaps not, but necessary." Tomard summoned Varley. With one arm around each man's shoulder, Ned managed to descend the steep tower steps and hobble across the bailey. "I want the guard doubled," he told Fat Tom. "No one enters or leaves the Tower of the Hand without my leave." Tom blinked.
"My lord, with Alan and the others away, we are hard-pressed already."
"It will only be a short while. Lengthen the watches."
"As you say, my lord," Tom answered. "Might I ask why?"
"Best not," Ned answered crisply. The guardswood was empty, as it always was here in the Citadel of the Southern Gods. Ned's leg was screaming as they lowered him to the grass beside the heart tree.
"Thank you."
He drew a paper from his sleeve, sealed with the sigil of his house. "Kindly deliver this at once." Tomard looked at the name Ned had written on the paper and licked his lips anxiously.
"My lord,
do as I bid you, Tom," Ned said. How long he waited in the quiet of the guardswood, he could not say. It was peaceful here. The thick wall shut out the clamour of the castle, and he could hear birds singing, the murmur of crickets, leaves rustling in a gentle wind. The heart tree was an oak, brown and faceless. Yet Ned Stark still felt the presence of his guards. His leg did not seem to hurt so much. She came to him at sunset, as the clouds reddened above the walls and towers. She came alone, as he had bid her. For once she was dressed simply, in leather boots and hunting greens. When she drew back the hood of her brown cloak, he saw the bruise where the king had struck her. The angry plum colour had faded to yellow, and the swelling was down, but there was no mistaking it for anything but what it was. "Why here?" Cersei Lannister asked, as she stood over him. "So the guards can see." She sat beside him on the grass. Her every move was graceful. Her curling blonde hair moved in the wind, and her eyes were green as the leaves of summer. It had been a long time since Ned Stark had seen her beauty, but he saw it now. "I know the truth John Aaron died for," he told her.
"Do you?"
The queen watched his face, wary as a cat. "Is that why you call me here, Lord Stark? To pose me riddles? Or is it your intent to seize me as your wife seized my brother?" "If you truly believe that, you would never have come." Ned touched her cheek gently. "Has he done this before?" "Once or twice." She shied away from his hand. "Never on the face before.
Jamie would have killed him, even if it meant his own life. Cersei looked at him defiantly. "My brother is worth 100 of your friend."
"Your brother?" Ned said. "Or your lover?"
"Both." She did not flinch from the truth. "Since we were children together.
And why not?"
"The Targaryens wed brother to sister for 300 years, to keep the bloodlines pure. And Jaime and I are more than brother and sister. We are one person in two bodies. We shared a womb together. He came into this world holding my foot," our old maester said. "When he is in me, I feel whole." The ghost of a smile flitted over her lips. "My son Bran." To her credit, Cersei did not look away. "He saw us." "You love your children, do you not?" Robert had asked him the very same question, the morning of the melee. He gave her the same answer. "With all my heart." "No less do I love mine." Ned thought, if it came to that, the life of some child I did not know against Rob and Sansa and Arya and Bran and Rickon, what would I do? Even more so, what would Catelyn do? If it were John's life against the children of her body? He did not know. He prayed he never would. "All three are Jaime's," he said. It was not a question. "Thank the gods." "The seed is strong," John Aaron had cried on his deathbed, and so it was. "All those bastards, all with hair as black as night. Grand Maester Malion recorded the last mating between stag and lion some 90 years ago, when Tyre Lannister wed Gowan Baratheon, third son of the reigning lord. Their only issue, an unnamed boy, described in Malion's tome as a large and lusty lad born with a full head of black hair, died in infancy. 30 years before that, a male Lannister had taken a Baratheon maid to wife. She had given him 3 daughters and a son, each black-haired. No matter how far back Ned searched in the brittle yellowed pages, always he found the gold yielding before the coal.
12 years, Ned said.
"How is it that you have had no children by the king?" She lifted her head, defiant. "Your Robert got me with child once," she said, her voice thick with contempt. "My brother found a woman to cleanse me. He never knew. If truth be told, I can scarcely bear for him to touch me, and I have not let him inside me for years. I know other ways to pleasure him, when he leaves his whores long enough to stagger up to my bedchamber. Whatever we do, the king is usually so drunk that he's forgotten it all by the next morning. How could they have all been so blind? The truth was there in front of them all the time, written on the children's faces." Ned felt sick. "I remember Robert as he was the day he took the throne. Every inch a king," he said quietly. "A 1,000 other women might have loved him with all their hearts. What did he do to make you hate him so?" Her eyes burned, green fire in the dusk, like the Linus that was her sigil. "The night of our wedding feast, the first time we shared a bed, he called me by your sister's name. He was on top of me, in me, stinking of wine, and he whispered, 'Lyanna.'" Ned Stark thought of pale blue roses, and for a moment he wanted to weep. "I do not know which of you I pity most." The queen seemed amused by that. "Save your pity for yourself, Lord Stark. I want none of it. You know what I must do."
"Must?"
She put her hand on his good leg just above the knee. "A true man does what he will, not what he must." Her fingers brushed lightly against his thigh, the gentlest of promises. "The realm needs a strong hand. Joff will not come of age for years. No one wants war again, least of all me." Her hand touched his face, his hair. "If friends can turn to enemies, enemies can become friends. Your wife is 1,000 leagues away, and my brother has fled.
Be kind to me, Ned. I swear to you, you shall never regret it.
Did you make the same offer to John Aaron?
She slapped him.
I shall wear that as a badge of honour, Ned said dryly.
Honour, she spat. How dare you play the noble lord with me? What do you take me for? You've a bastard of your own. I've seen him. Who was the mother, I wonder? Some Dornish peasant you raped while her holdfast burned? A whore? Or was it the grieving sister, the Lady Ashara? She threw herself into the sea, I'm told. Why was that? For the brother you slew? Or the child you stole? Tell me, my honourable Lord Eddard, how are you any different from Robert, or me, or Jamie?
For a start, said Ned, I do not kill children.
You'd do well to listen, my lady. I shall say this only once. When the king returns from his hunt, I intend to lay the truth before him. You must be gone by then, you and your children, all three, and not to Casterly Rock. If I were you, I should take ship for the free cities, or even farther, to the Summer Isles or the port of Ibbon, as far as the winds blow.
Exile, she said, a bitter cup to drink from.
A sweeter cup than your father served Rhaegar's children, Ned said, and kinder than you deserve. Your father and your brothers would do well to go with you. Lord Tywin's gold would buy you comfort and hire swords to keep you safe. You shall need them. I promise you, no matter where you flee, Robert's wrath will follow you, to the back of beyond if need be. The queen stood.
And what of my wrath, Lord Stark? She asked softly. Her eyes searched his face.
You should have taken the realm for yourself. It was there for the taking. Jamie, tell me how you found him, on the Iron Throne, the day King's Landing fell, and made him yield it up.
That was your moment. All you needed to do was climb those steps and sit.
Such a sad mistake. I have made more mistakes than you can possibly imagine, Ned said. But that was not one of them.
Oh, but it was, my lord, Cersei insisted. When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
She turned up her hood to hide her swollen face and left him there, in the dark, beneath the oak, amidst the quiet of the guard's wood, under a blue-black sky. The stars were coming out. Daenerys. The heart was steaming in the cool evening air when Khal Drogo set it before her, raw and bloody. His arms were red to the elbow. Behind him his blood riders knelt on the sand beside the corpse of the wild stallion, stone knives in their hands. The stallion's blood looked black in the flickering orange glare of the torches that ringed the high chalk walls of the pit. Danny touched the soft swell of her belly. Sweat beaded her skin and trickled down her brow. She could feel the old women watching her, the ancient crones of the Vaes Dothrak, with eyes that shone dark as polished flint in their wrinkled faces. She must not flinch or look afraid. "I am the blood of the dragon," she told herself, as she took the stallion's heart in both hands, lifted it to her mouth, and plunged her teeth into the tough, stringy flesh. Warm blood filled her mouth and ran down over her chin. The taste threatened to gag her, but she made herself chew and swallow. The heart of a stallion would make her son strong and swift and fearless, or so the Dothraki believed, but only if the mother could eat it all. If she choked on the blood or retched up the flesh, the omens were less favourable. The child might be stillborn, or come forth weak, deformed or female. Her handmaidens had helped her ready herself for the ceremony. Despite the tender mother's stomach that had afflicted her these past 2 moons, Danny had dined on bowls of half-clotted blood to accustom herself to the taste. And Eri made her chew strips of dried horseflesh until her jaws were aching.
She had starved herself for a day and a night before the ceremony in the hopes that hunger would help her keep down the raw meat. The wild stallion's heart was all muscle.